Blog Talk Radio.
Again to a special edition of Beyond the Cover. Again, this is our second part of Thriller Fest 2015 interview show with your host John Robb and Jeff Bears. And Jeff is here eating. Jeff, how you doing?
Doing great, and I can't believe it's August already. Holy moly.
I know, I can't believe it's August. I was just saying it the other day, and I'm like, we haven't really got the massive heat wave that we normally get in July, and you know, and I'm sure it's coming soon, but it's like,
well, maybe
soon,
you have.
We're all gonna be. Yeah, well, that's right. In Seattle, you guys did get it. I was like, I can't believe it. And it's even worse because your sun never seems to set.
Yeah, exactly. It was almost 90 degrees again today.
Yeah, the only city in the United States I know where the sun literally doesn't really set. Okay, in the continental United States, because I know in Alaska, does set. Yeah, but I mean, that was probably one of the most shocking things when we went to Seattle. With that, I had no idea that that was what it was. So,
but then in the winter, watch out.
That's true. In the winter, yeah, you got no sun.
Exactly.
You know, but you get to wear fleece. You know, there's something nice and comforting about being able to wear fleece and sweatshirts and sweatpants, and you kind of wake up and you got that crisp air, and you know, you can put stuff on to warm up. You can only take so much shit off to cool off before you're eventually just stuck in air conditioning. So. That's why I'm more partial to cold than I am to heat.
Yep, I love my layers, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, speaking of layers, we're going to layer this threefold tonight. We got three fabulous interviews that we did at Thriller Fest, and we still got some more to come up on another show. Of course, next week we are going to have Kevin O'Brien on. We'll be playing one interview with that on the back end of Kevin O'Brien. And he's a fabulous guy. You guys are going to really love listening to him. He's hilarious. And you wouldn't think that he writes really scary freaking horror books from talking to and interviewing the guy because he's so freaking funny.
That's true.
But that's the best part. You know, you can see him on one side the way he is and then another side in his book. I mean, they're two totally different people. And I think that that's important that people know, too, that no, he's not some recluse that just sits in his house and thinks on how to kill people. I mean, he does do that, but he doesn't just do that. So I think that's
and we don't have to call the cops on him.
Yeah, that's true. He's allowed to kill people without calling the cops.
Exactly.
So first up tonight, we are going to have author. We've had him. I've interviewed him several times on the radio show. He's always a fabulous interview. Author John Land is going to be on. And then we are going to have Joseph Badal come on after that. And then we're going to finish it up with Joseph Finder. So we got a great group of guys for you tonight. We got three great guys, and they're all J's. So it's the Triple J show.
Oh,
in
that's
fact,
right.
It's the quintuple
five.
J show, because we got five. I don't know if quintuplet is the right word for five. I think so, because isn't sextuplet six? So wouldn't
yes.
quintuplet mm-hmm. be? So it's the quintuplet J's tonight. Wow, we got a lot of J's on the show. But let's hit it off, and let's get on with John Land talking about several different things. Of course, he'll be talking about his latest book. Well, Strong Darkness came out, and then Strong Light of Day, I believe, is the next one coming up. And so you're going to hear all that fun stuff. Later on with the Joseph Finder interview, you're going to hear about his times on the set with Morgan Freeman on High Crimes and what role he played in that. And then a little bit about Paranoia and what role he didn't play in that. So, that's another
nice teaser.
On. Exactly. So let's hit it now with John Land and enjoy.
All right, and here's Jeff and I again at Thriller Fest, and we are now talking with author John Land. John, how you doing?
I'm doing great. I almost have my voice back. I'm recovering.
I know. I lost mine, I think, Tuesday and Wednesday.
There are nobody has a voice anymore.
We're going to lose it tonight for sure after this banquet.
Well, what are you going to do?
Yeah, but then it's Saturday night, and you don't have to worry about it until tomorrow. Exactly.
That's right.
So now we're winding down. Thriller Fest 10, the banquet's coming up. Mm-hmm. And so we have to ask the question, of course, what does Thriller Fest mean to you? Because you've been involved for so long, and you've been on the board of the ITW, so you've been involved in many of these. And then what should new authors expect when they come to an event like this?
I think the answer, those are two questions that have the same answer.
Okay.
And for me, and for anyone who comes here, it's an opportunity to form relationships, to network, to look both up and to remind yourself to look not up, to look down. Because ITW exists as an organization for the writers who have achieved a measure of success to help others reach that level, perhaps even exceed it. At the same time, you know, you have an opportunity at any level to further yourself. Because let's face it, everyone wants to know what's in it for them.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing the right thing, this is very rare, that when you do the right thing, you get the right payback. But here's an organization and an event where if you're a new author, you can meet people, you can ask for quotes, blurbs, mm-hmm. you can meet reviewers, you can really start to lay the groundwork for what creates your brand as an author. For someone at my level trying to make that next step, that next leap up to the New York Times level, you can form the kind of relationships that you would never have been able to form. Perfect example, Heather Graham and I are doing a book that will be published right before Thriller Fest next year.
Yeah.
I would never have met Heather Graham and have this opportunity if it wasn't for ITW and Thriller Fest. In fact, without going into great detail, which would be dull, suffice it to say that I don't even know if I would be doing what I'm doing anymore, at least not successfully, if it wasn't for ITW and the organization in general and the conference in specific.
That's a great answer. I'm going to follow up because when you're saying the ITW and everything, how publishing has changed, 2,500 new books a week go out, without an organization and a support system like the ITW and Thriller Fest, if there wasn't anything like that, could you even foreshadow to see how an author could even put themselves above anybody else to sell really any books?
It's a great question. And let me answer it this way. It's our 10th anniversary. Mm-hmm. 10 years ago, nobody knew what an ebook was, and maybe they had just started, but nobody saw what was coming, not a single person. There were people who said they did. On the other hand, today we had 29 debut authors on the stage. 10 of their publishers didn't exist 10 years ago. And what this tells me is that, and I think this is a crucial point for everyone involved, that publishing went through a paradigm shift. And unlike music, and to a lesser extent film, and this is all with regards to the economy and the loss of all the bookstores, we went through a paradigm shift to the point where 5 years ago, I think it was even money whether even books, hardcover books, would exist right now.
Mm-hmm. That was a real conversation.
It was, and they do, and print revenue is rising to the point where, you know, there are stories that Barnes & Noble is going to cut Nook and expand print. So the music model has not penetrated the book model. And this is a crucial point to make, because it means that our industry, although redefined, is thriving for those who know how to utilize it and how to negotiate it and how to steer through the obstacle course. You can't do the same thing you always did anymore and expect the same results. It's not going to be there. You need to find new routes to the same place you wanted to get. In 10 years, that's the kind of thing that's changed. Mm-hmm. What this has done, in an auxiliary answer, an ancillary answer to the question, is it's made the community of writers tighter. Because as I said in my introduction, which I do every year on Wednesday morning of Thriller Fest, quoting someone, and I had just received a tweet about this, quoting someone, that we are stronger together than we are alone. And I think what this organization offers is it's no magic bullet, but you can get the map that has, you still have to draw the lines yourself, but you'll see what to avoid, and you'll see how to get where you want to go.
Well, that brings up a question that I've asked a couple of other authors we've been talking to today, and that is, when you are writing your kick-ass books, you are solitary.
Yes.
In front of a computer, everything else. And then you come to a place like this, and all of a sudden it's the complete opposite. You are sociable. You've got to be sociable, networking and all that other stuff. Talk about that switch for me.
Wow.
Just don't scare us like Joseph Fender did.
It's very humbling. Because when you're in your box, you're always looking up at the 1%, 1.001% of people in this profession who are over me. That's all I think about. I never think about anyone else because I don't think you set your goals higher, so you aim higher. But then you get to something like this, and you meet so many authors, the other 99.5%, mm-hmm. who are just trying to get where I am. And they do anything to have a career and make a living at what I do. Right. And what this does, when I say humility, I think it any writer who's achieved a measure, a degree of success, has, if you're going to be part of this organization, you have an obligation to help others get where you are. And you realize when you're in a room, you know, that so many people are trying to get to that place, are aiming high. And the difference between them and me is far, far greater than me and the big bestsellers that the big bestselling author that I aspire to be. Mm-hmm. And I want to do everything that I can to help them get there. Because those above me did everything they could to help me. And I think that attitude that ITW breeds is unique in any writer's organization and perhaps any organization in the creative arts at all. You know, I don't know much about actors or artists or dancers or other writers' organizations. I just know there's something about this place. When people leave, they always leave with a smile, and they always leave impressed.
Mm-hmm. That's true. A follow-up here. So I got to say, to me personally, I would think if I'm aspiring to be where you are, and I would prefer something like your career over someone like the big leagues, because a lot of those folks are not writing great books. And you write quality books on a regular basis. So I toss out to you, do you, you understand my question here?
I understand it perfectly, and I'm going to quote, of all people, Arnold Schwarzenegger in the movie Pumping Iron.
We've never had that happen yet.
When he was asked after winning Mr. Universe for the third year in a row, no one had ever won it twice in a row, and they had won it three, and he says, how do you do it? What keeps you going? And he looked at the camera. He was just learning to speak English well. This is not far before Conan and Terminator. Stay hungry. Passion. You have to maintain your passion. And what you're alluding to, what you're referring to, is the fact that when you achieve the level of success that I aspire to, when you reach it, do you lose the same passion? Or, I hope, on the other hand, you bear an even greater responsibility to the people who brought you there, all the people who bought your books. The worst thing someone could tell me was, I liked you a lot better before you were big. You know, it's kind of like, oh, so now I've got all the money and I'm on the, and I can see my name in the New York Times bestseller list, but people don't like my books anymore. You know, I know in my heart they're not as good as they used to be. And what will stop that from happening with me is, one, the obligation I bear to my readers that disappointing them means disappointing myself. And two, if I am very good at letting my characters do the work, and I believe that my first New York Times bestseller will be followed up by an even better book because it will create a greater responsibility to live up to those expectations. And not a lesser. opportunity. I look at Stephen King's career, arguably the most successful writer in history over the course of time, the same way Bruce Springsteen, longevity.
Very well, yeah.
But Stephen King has had a lot of bumps in the road where the books just weren't very good.
Sure.
And, but here he is in his 60s, and he seems to be writing as well as he ever did. Seems to be able to still capture, and why is that? Because Stephen King, I think this came out, I think this came out at Thriller Fest with Greg Iles. Stephen King can still write from the imagination of a five-year-old. He still has the magic. He still wants to make the magic. And I think that any writer at any level of success, as long as you don't lose that magic, you will never decline as a writer. Because many of the authors, Jeff, that you just referred to, of them used to write, but they did write better books at one time. That quality got them to a certain level, and in addition to sometimes fortune is the residue of design. But it's the ability to use the same formula of hard work and especially passion that got you where you're going to keep you there.
So now, let's just jump right into your writing now. Caitlin Strong. Strong Darkness is the latest book.
Yes.
That is out.
Yes.
And
he's got the new one coming out.
Strong Light of Day is coming out soon. So the one question that I had asked another author, and I think it was Joseph Finder, was, in each book, is there something when you're cultivating and you're getting your plot and you're getting it together, do you say, I'm going to take a risk this time this way, and you go ahead and you try to do it? And whether you succeed or you fail, do you go in with that mindset?
Your timing is perfect for that question. It's almost like... In Strong Light of Day, I've probably taken the biggest emotional risk for my characters that I've ever done.
Hmm.
You know, and I owe a certain man sitting to my right, Mr. Jeff Ayers, the fact that he gave me away to turn an emotional risk into a structural highlight. Any book needs two cores, the emotional core and the structural core. The best books unite them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what Strong Light of Day does. Because a very conservative person who read it, a blogger, and I just sent it, the reason I sent it to her early was because she got spammed on my email. And I felt bad, so I said, hey, I know you love my books. You're one of the first people to receive this. And she wrote me back and said, well, I didn't know where you were going with this. But then it was the aha moment, she called it. And then I got it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a cop-out? No. Because that's going to be carried over into other books. It's the revelation about a character, one of the kids that Caitlin is a surrogate mother for. That would have been a lot more risky a few years ago. But isn't really, I don't think, it's a risk because I've never seen it done in thriller fiction before, ever. And that makes it a risk. But you know what?
We want something different, but we want the same.
You cannot succeed to the level that I want to succeed as a storyteller. Not just numbers, but as a storyteller. If you're not willing to take these kind of risks and push your characters emotionally. The reason why so many series go stale is nobody changes. Nobody evolves. I won't mention anything. I don't want to disparage anyone, but sure. I will mention James Lee Burke. Dave Robichaux ages. And every book, he's a little older, and it affects him.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where we may not see him anymore as a detective. He may be gone in that respect. There may be nowhere else to take him, but that's as far as James Lee Burke could go. Robert Parker says the biggest mistake he made with Spencer is making him a Korean War vet. Because once you do that, if someone reads that book and goes, wait a minute, Spencer's 90.
Yeah.
You destroy the sacred relationship between author and reader when you don't age your characters chronologically. Fleming knew this when he wrote Bond. Arthur Conan Doyle knew this when he wrote Holmes. They changed as the books went on and they got older. The difference between James Bond and Casino Royale, the first book, mm-hmm. and Men with the Golden Gun, the final book, he is an entirely different human being from what Fleming introduced him as. And he had been through so much, if you read the books in order, which I kind of did when I was in my early teens.
Mm-hmm.
That makes the series so much richer. Bond never dies. Holmes did, but came back.
Right.
It makes the series so much richer because it allows you to explore emotional growth, which is what makes you like the characters. John D. MacDonald, who created Travis McGee, and he's one of the great novelists of the 20th century, was asked once, what's the story? And he said, stuff happens to people you care about. There are thrillers to this day that had a lot of stuff, but you don't always care about the characters, especially after the first and second book in the series. Because the characters aren't being challenged anymore. Dave Robichaux, get back, James Lee Burke has had three wives. We've watched his daughter grow up. We've watched his best friend, Cleet Purcell, continue to degenerate. I have trouble reading, even before he died, I had trouble reading Spencer. Because I couldn't get past the fact that he was old. Now you say, well, you can't do that. Because if you do that, sooner or later you'll have to stop writing your hero. Well, Caitlin's 35, 36 maybe, in real time. She was 29 or so in the first book.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you back up. You know, I'm doing a generational saga, basically. I can't cheat because she has four relatives, her great-great-grandfather, her great-grandfather, grandfather, and father were all Texas Rangers. Well, there's a timeline.
Right.
And if you cheat that timeline, you cheat the reader. And that's not fair. You're breaking the rules, the sacred bond, the sacred trust.
I see we're running a little short here. I wanted to say, one of the things that's nice is you are writing a lead character that's also female,
mm-hmm.
which is also a rare thing. And I know you've talked about how that was sort of the inspiration for her to begin with.
It was the inspiration because it was kind of a cutthroat commercial decision, but some of the best creative decisions you make are based on marketing and business. You do what's best for your business. You don't, you know, you don't put up, if you're in business and you're Ford or you're Procter & Gamble, you test the hell out of a product before you release it because you want it to succeed. You want to give it a chance to succeed. To come up with a book series that, and you don't know how it's going to succeed, is the equivalent to Procter & Gamble just throwing a new bar of soap out there on the stand without doing all the prep. So Caitlin is in a genre that is the most popular genre, where women still dominate sales, she is, in my mind, the lone true action thriller heroine, a female Jack Reacher. Now, can a man write a woman? Let me ask you a question. How many writers write serial killers? How many have they killed?
A lot.
You know, how many, you know, Martin Cruz Smith made his name with Gorky Park.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't even speak Russian. You know, he wasn't Russian. The whole book was set in Russia. It was all mm-hmm. about Russians. To me, people are people, and they come to life in my imagination, and I write them whatever way that they demand to be written. In Strong Enough to Die, Guillermo Paz wasn't supposed to survive. He had other plans, and now he's a vital part of the series. In Strong Vengeance, the greatest villain I've ever created, one of the scariest scenes I've ever written, Chapter 41, Strong Vengeance, is the introduction of a villain who turns out to be a pedophile. I had no idea when I started to write that scene that's what was going to happen. And when I wrote that dialogue, I was literally shaking. And every time I read it, I'm like, I got goosebumps now just mm-hmm. thinking of what he does and what he says to Dylan. I don't know where that came from. But if I can write something, if I can write a pedophile, I think I can write a woman. And the whole point of that scene is, again, to the point I made before about the ingenious man to my right, blending, giving me a way out of the emotional crisis that I had created for the characters to turn into a structural strength. Well, the reason that scene works in Strong Vengeance is he knows, Jalbert Toms, the villain, knows exactly what he's doing. He knows exactly what he's doing when he does what he does with Dylan. He means it when he's looking at this really attractive boy. He means what he's saying, but he knows what's going to happen. Caitlin's going to come gunning for him. Caitlin's going to walk into an ambush because she's a Texas Ranger. It's going to be her and him.
Mm-hmm.
Even though You just tell her to meet me at a bar at 9 o'clock. Well, in a traditional thriller with a traditional hero, you would never have that happen. You'd call the SWAT team.
Right.
But that guy knows that Caitlin is going to come herself because that guy crossed the line and he's going to get pushed back. That's the code that she lives by. That's not because she's a woman. It's because she's a person with a deep abiding love and respect for this boy. Kind of his surrogate mother. She witnessed the murder of his mother. You just don't do that with her. And I don't know where that comes from. I just know that it's her. And I don't, and maybe I created her, gave her a name and a notion. Everything else is her own business. Everything else came from her. Came internally from a part of me I don't understand. I don't know where it comes from. If I did, I could write books about it and make far more money telling other people how to do what I do.
Right.
But I don't know where it comes from. Greg Isles said yesterday, and there's a lot of truth to this, you're born with it. And I don't fully agree with that, but I think there's a lot to be said for there is something in you about being creative that is part of your nature, that is part of your essence, that is part of your aura, your persona, everything. And I think part of the reason why I became a writer, a huge part of the reason is I never planned to be a writer. I never studied writing. I got pushed to be a writer, almost like I stopped fighting the riptide. I started going with the flow. I heard this inner voice inside me. And the greatest gift anyone can have is to be able to make a living in what they love to do.
So one last question, because the one thing that I see in publishing and the one thing that you don't do, and I think a lot of the really, really good writers, and I don't mean the ones who sell a lot of books, what they do not do is you're not chasing trends. Because there's a lot of people that write to chase trends, and I think that there's a lot of stumbles that come upon that. How do you kind of pull yourself back? Because you know that maybe if you do chase that trend, maybe you will end up on that bestseller list, but maybe inside you won't feel good from yourself writing because you did something outside the box, maybe just to sell a couple extra books to do that. So how do you keep yourself true to yourself and not chase trends?
I try to create the next trend. I try to look peer into my crystal ball. I'll give you an example. Strong Light of Day, without giving too much away, but I will. Strong Light of Day, which is the next Caitlin Strong, yep, is about agro-terrorism, an attack on the nation's food supply. Well, I've never seen a thriller about agro-terrorism. That's not a trend. But if it works for me, other people will probably try it. In Strong Light of Day, it's there is a difference between a societal, international trend or the revival of the Cold War is not a trend. It's a historical fact.
Mm-hmm.
Vampires are a trend.
Right.
Books like Shades of Grey.
Zombies. Those things.
Zombies.
Yeah, a trend.
Those would be. Those are trends, and they do affect packaging of books. I think everyone looks at Strong Dark and says Walking Dead. So there's a look they wanted to give it to give you a spooky feeling.
Mm-hmm.
But you avoid following trends by trying to peer beyond them. Because if it's a trend, if I know it's a trend, it's already over. By the time the book comes out, which is going to be a year from the time I start a book, it's 15 months.
Mm-hmm.
If I know about it and I'm not, if in pop culture, it's done. It's over. When you can identify something as a trend, it's time not to write about it. It's time to create. You want to be... You want to create a paradigm shift instead of following the paradigm shift. And I think that's where... I also believe that you get caught up in language and what we call things and labels. But the fact is, if you tell a great story, and you're with characters the reader cares about. Now, with me... The Caitlin Strong books haven't followed a trend, but they've evolved into much bigger thrillers. I mean, someone said recently, Caitlin Bond.
That's good.
It's Caitlin Bond now. I mean, she's up against Chinese, she's up against Russians. In Strong Cold Dead, she's up against ISIS coming to Texas. But not the way you would think. I mean, I'll tell you that right now.
Mm-hmm.
But that is ISIS a trend? If that's the case, then yeah, I'm exploiting something that's part of our fabric of the modern day.
But we think about it. I mean, we think about ISIS on a regular basis.
We do, and the thing that that is a great point, because heroes do what the rest of us can't, and they make us feel safe. I remember, and this is when you watch a great story, you read a great story, the little kid in you comes back out. And I know I'm a big Homeland fan on Showtime.
Yeah.
And when there's a major twist that they've left the embassy unguarded and the bad guys are coming in through the tunnels, the one guy who's left behind is a special ops guy. And I'm just thinking, come on, Quinn. You got to get there, Quinn. Quinn, you can do this. You can kill. You can take them all down. It's like the super. It's what Nietzsche called the Superman. You want, or in this case, the Superwoman. Someone who can cathartically do what the reader cannot do against forces that would threaten the reader's life, and you know, and that's what the nature. That's the definition of heroism to a great extent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if all that happens in my books is what anybody could do, then why are they reading them? Caitlin Strong, and I mean, it's getting almost humorous, tongue-in-cheek, where there's times where people say, what is it with Texas where everything, you get involved in all these things? You know, how is it that is Texas on some fault line? You know, and to an extent, maybe it is, all this crazy stuff that happens in Texas.
Well, you did have a scene in Brown, but...
Well, I have done that, and I, you know, the question is that she's so defined as a Texas Ranger. Well, you must stay with the credibility. Texas Rangers aren't, you know, I've brought her to Canada. I've had her in the Middle East. You know, she is going to get out of Texas a little bit in this next in the next book, Strong Cold Dead. Because
mm-hmm.
I do think that's the nature of the organic storytelling that I deal with. Because there are people who say, I'm competing with international thrillers. I'm competing with Steve Berry, and I'm competing with Jim Rollins, and I'm competing with books that are sweeping the globe. And my books are staying in a very large swath of territory, because it's mm-hmm. Texas. But they're the same stories. They're quest stories. They're about really bad people trying to do really bad things. What's the difference where they are? And that's what, as long as someone is there to stand against them. And that's Caitlin Strong.
Mm-hmm. I love it.
Well, I'll tell you what, John, this has been a pleasure, as always. I mean, every time we talk to you, we always seem to touch on new things, new subjects, and we always have new conversations, and I think that's why we always have great conversations.
We never cover the
same thing twice.
And that's the same thing you must do in writing.
Yeah.
You can't repeat yourself.
Right.
And when you start writing the same book over and over again, something's wrong.
Something's wrong. Again, thanks so much.
It's been awesome.
And we will see you guys all again.
Here we are.
There we go.
And there we go. We out. That was great, though, Jeff. That was a good one. I always
love talking to John.
And, you know, I was about ready to say, and if you do write the same book twice, then you could just call yourself Jay and Ivanovich. I'm just joking. I swear to God, that was a joke. All right, I was just joking on that one. No, I'm just joking, but it's true. But I'm still joking. And you know, that's just the way it goes. I'm just trying to, you know, I think I do these things to try to start a war with somebody just for the hell of it, and it's just a manufactured war that means absolutely nothing, because I love all the authors and I love everything that they do, because it's not a very easy thing to do regardless. So yeah, I just like to have fun with them. No big deal. It's all in good fun.
Someday,
right?
Janet's going to come after you. I'm just telling you this now.
You know what? I would love her if she killed me in her book. In fact, when we have Kevin O'Brien on next week, he will tell you who he kills off in his book and why he does it. Because I thought that was a very interesting conversation, but I'm going to tease that one for next week. Because he has a very, remember when he said he has a very specific reason for killing off certain people in his book? Remember that?
Yes.
So I'm going to have him reveal that one. But now let's get over to our next guest. He is author Joseph Bedall. His books are out right now. He is the author of the Danforth series. with four books. His last two books won best book at the New Mexico Book Festival in the Hillerman Ward. And here we go. You ready?
Let's do it.
You sure?
No.
You want to do it now?
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, we go now. Okay, here we go. Okay.
Okay, so we're here with Joseph Bedal at Thriller Fest, and we're going to be talking to him about what's going on at the convention here in New York City. So, Joseph, how are you doing today?
Doing great. Thanks for having me, John.
So let's just get right into it. Thriller Fest is a conference for ITW authors and fans to come and see what's going on. But as an author, a very successful author of, what, you have seven, eight books now?
Eight
books. What does Thriller Fest mean to you every year that you come here?
Well, you know, I go to a lot of conferences, and it's a great way to get to know other authors, learn new techniques to hone my craft, and also to meet readers. But the thing about Thriller Fest is that despite the fact that it's a very large conference, the authors are accessible. The publishers are accessible. You go to some conferences, they got a green room where they hide the New York Times best-selling
right.
authors, not at Thriller Fest. And so it's just an awesome place to meet people that have been at it longer than you have, or for that matter, people that might be writing their first novel. And you learn something. I always figure if I can go to a conference, any conference, and I can learn one thing that can improve me as a writer, then it's been well worth the time and effort and expense and so forth. And Thriller Fest is one of the best because I always learn more than one thing. So.
And Thriller Fest is broken down into different parts. Like, so we're here Wednesday, the conference just started, but this first 2 days are what they call Craft Fest.
Right.
So you get a lot of authors that are teaching you. David Morrell teaches classes, D.P. Lyle, Steve Barry. They'll teach you how to write. And then you have the second half, which is Pitch Fest, which comes at the end of Craft Fest, where new authors can pitch their books to agents or publishers that are there. And then Friday, Saturday is Thriller Fest, where you have a lot of authors that are on panels and doing things, and you're going to be on a panel.
Right.
So when you first started arriving, was Craft Fest, was that something that you were very interested in? You hit as many classes as you could to just understand the essence of writing and how those things did, and that's where you were kind of learning, and then Thriller Fest was more of the fun fan because it's more of a laid-back kind of thing. So what was more important to you coming first? Was it the Craft Fest or the Thriller Fest part that you were excited about seeing first?
Well, that's a difficult question because I think they both have a huge amount of value. Sure, I love to meet fans and build my fan base at Thriller Fest, but even at Thriller Fest, I still am learning things by attending panels. So in many ways, Thriller Fest is similar to Craft Fest. But I would, to answer your question, I think Craft Fest was so helpful the first time I attended, and still is. And that's why I'm here. I come in Tuesday and I attend Craft Fest, participate in Pitch Fest. I'm a panel master in Thriller Fest, so I'm committed. Mm-hmm. This is a great way to spend 3 or 4 days.
Now, you said panel master. What exactly is a panel master?
Oh, that means I have to herd cats. I've got five other authors, five egos that I've got to make sure they get, you know, our panel topic is twists and turns and thrillers, and I got to make sure that one author doesn't dominate the conversation and make sure that the people in attendance get what they paid for.
Mm-hmm.
And so and we have a very diverse group of authors on our panel, so I think they're going to have a unique take on everything that we discuss in the panels.
Do you know who's on your panel this year?
We've got Chris Bell I'm sorry, I can't remember all their names right now. But.
So basically when you're a panel master, you're asking questions of the authors, and it's a fun, laid-back situation. It's about 55 minutes. People can ask questions in the audience,
right.
and they kind of get a taste of what each author does in their writing. And
right.
so you're there to kind of moderate all that situation.
That's right.
And then you do the flip side, and then you're on a panel. So then you're kind of doing the same thing, so people are asking you questions. And are you on a panel doing a topic, or are you just moderating?
I'm just moderating.
You're just moderating. And when a new author comes to Thriller Fest and they're trying to figure out, okay, what am I going to get out of it? Because, I mean, it's not cheap. You have to come to New York City. You're at the Hyatt. I mean, you know, things are expensive, but it's an investment in the business that you choose to get into.
That's right.
Whether it's retail or whatever, you have to put an initial investment to get going, right. And you have to keep putting money back into your product. What can a new author expect when they come to Thriller Fest for the first time? They walk in, they're bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, and all of a sudden they see Lee Child walking down the hall, David Morrell, and all these great authors. What can they expect when they first come in, and what should they try to take out of it? What should be their focus?
Yeah, well, first of all, you make a great point that attending these kind of conferences is a way of investing in your business. And writing is not just an art, it's a business. And you'd better be prepared to pay for that airfare and hotel room and the registration fees and so forth. And as far as what people should expect, well, first of all, my feeling has always been that you're going to learn a whole lot more by listening than by talking. And if you have an opportunity, if you run into Lee Childs, I guarantee you, you can stop Lee Childs in the hall here at Thriller Fest and say, could you share your experiences with me, or I've got a question about this or that, and that's one of the things that's great about Thriller Fest is that the successful authors are willing to share with those that are on their way up, and I would suggest any aspiring author or newly published authors to come here. Don't be shy about introducing yourself to people and have one question to ask them. Ask David Morrell, you know, how'd you get started, or ask Lee Childs, how'd you come up with Jack Reacher, you put all of those, the answers that you get to those questions, and you're going to wind up having a body of information that's going to help you become a better author, better writer.
And now the one thing, when you're also here, you get so many different tips, because it's not just thrillers. You have, you know, you have authors that write cozy mysteries. You have them that write thriller. You have them that write horror, you know, suspense. I mean, they're all in with that tangent. And you mainly write, you know, thrillers. You have your Danforth series. But your latest book, Borderline, came out, and it's a mystery. When you're coming to a conference like this, do you get inspired from hearing other authors writing in their genre and say, you know what, that's interesting, and that's something I want to explore personally, because I think that some authors might get a little tired of maybe writing the same thing over and over. Like anything, you want to, you know, kind of explore yourself. So is that something that you kind of decided to do?
Absolutely. That's a very, very good point and a good question. One of the things that you can become stale, and your readers can also get tired of if you're doing the same thing over and over again. And what you want to do is avoid your books becoming formulaic. And so, for instance, you mentioned the Danforth saga. We've had four books published in the Danforth saga. The fifth one, Death Ship, will be out in October. But what I've done is sandwich between the fifth one and the fourth one, a couple standalone, one a thriller, Ultimate Betrayal, and then my first mystery, Borderline. And it was just a way to kind of get a fresh approach. I've been stimulated to do that as a result of talking to other authors who have kind of, you know, gone through a period of time where they've written a series and then said, you know, I'm going to freshen my thinking up a little bit. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when you step away from something that you've been doing, whether it's a series of standalones or a series itself in a particular genre, you kind of clear your head and you can come back to that series or that genre later on and really, as I said, feel refreshed and approach it a little differently and hopefully more capably. So.
And now, before we kind of get on and start recording, we started talking, you know, a little bit about, you looked back at your first books and now you look at them now and you say that you have written so much better now than you did at the beginning, and even talking about maybe going back and rewriting parts of the first books because they maybe weren't quite as polished as you'd like them to be. Why though would you want to kind of go back and change something that's already out instead of just kind of leaving it alone and then just progressing forward?
Well, a variety of reasons. Let's take the Pythagorean Solution, which was my first book and was published in 2003. That's almost a generation has passed since 2003. So we're now 12 years later. If a new reader, a new thriller reader, were to pick up the original version of that book, it takes place in 2003. The backstory is Vietnam. And a lot of those new readers might not relate. Technology has changed.
iPhones weren't even around in 2003.
No, that's right. I mean, I'm referring to pagers. And
what's a pager?
What's a pager, right? And so, it gave. Not only did it give me an opportunity to go ahead and make technology current, change the backstory so that the protagonist and other characters are more relatable to the average reader today, but it also gave me a chance to improve my writing. That was my first book. I know it had some of the flaws that first books often have, and now it's many books later, and so Suspense Publishing just released the Pythagorean Solution on April 28th, and it's been one of my best-selling books ever.
It's been going good.
And I think the writing's better. The story is current. The backstory has been brought forward from Vietnam to the Middle East, and it was a fun project. I really enjoyed doing it, and it's a little bit like taking a painting you did 12 years ago and saying, my technique's better today. I'm going to redo that and see what I can do with it. And it was a fun project.
But the one thing that's also interesting is that the character stayed the same. Their mentality and their creativity or whatever they were involved in stayed the same. You just changed the world around them.
That's right. Well said.
Yeah. And so that's the one thing. One thing that I think, especially authors, whoever's kind of listening, fans, to kind of understand the process of what an author has to go through, because from beginning to end, when you first sit down to either think about a book or write on the page for the first time, how long does it take for you to finish? Because this is something that I think a lot of people don't understand, and 90% of new authors don't realize the length and the time and the effort that it would take to finish a book. So for you, how long does it take from beginning to end?
Well, the process and the time in each step of the process has really changed from the first book. The first book took me 3 years to write. And there was a lot of editing going on. I still do a lot of editing, and I still have an outside editor. But today, on average, I'd say it, between writing a book and re-editing and re-editing and re-editing it, it is probably a year's process.
A year.
And then, because I don't want something out that's pedestrian. Mm-hmm. I want people to say, and I get this a lot, and it's probably the most complimentary thing a reader can say to me, and that is, I couldn't put the book down. Mm-hmm. By the way, I just ordered the next book. I want to make sure, and that's why I'm pathological about editing, and I want to make sure that I put my best work out there. And then the publisher goes through the book, and...
Yes, she does.
And one of the things I'm very proud of is that there isn't a lot of work that has to be done on the part of the publisher in editing mm-hmm. my work, because I've been so careful about presenting the best I think I can do to Suspense Publishing. And then you got at least a couple, 3 months to get the book out, you know, at least. And so, and it's really a year and a half process from the time I sit down and start a manuscript to the point that it's out there in the public.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then, of course, then once it starts going, you have, you know, in that three-month period of when you're done and when covers are being worked on and the publishing process is going forward, that's kind of when you're starting to market, hey, it's coming out. Yeah. You know, it's July now. You're going to start seeing it in October,
right,
and you start working on that process, which
right,
is a whole other different ballgame.
That's right.
Which you get tips about that here at Thriller Fest, too. People kind of
good
let
point
you know.
Yep.
And then they understand yep that. Well, we're going to finish up. Why don't you tell everybody where they can find your work and where the best place is to maybe contact you and get involved with what you're doing and figure out more about your writing and your future
yep
stuff.
Well, all of my books are available at bookstores because they're distributed by Ingram. They're also available on Amazon, both in Kindle form as well as in print form.
Mm-hmm.
The my eighth book and my first mystery, Borderline, was just released on June the 30th, and my next book will be the fifth in the Danforth saga, out in October, which is called Death Ship. So, and I'm started a new series, and the first one in that should be out, assuming that Suspense Publishing likes it, sometime in 2016.
And you have a little bit of pressure because the last two times, the conference that you're going to do, New Mexico, Ultimate Betrayal and Lone Wolf have won awards.
That's right.
So now you have to see if you can three-peat.
Oh, well, that from your lips to God's ears.
And would that be borderline? That would be the three-peater.
Well, we hope. The Ultimate Betrayal won the Tony Hillerman Award for Best Fiction Book in last year's contest, and the year before, The Lone Wolf Agenda was voted the best in the thriller mystery category.
Mm-hmm.
So it's I've been very lucky, and I'm looking forward to Borderline. Hopefully,
see what happens on
you,
that one.
You probably jinxed me.
No, Michael Jordan's three-peated. We can three-peat. It can happen.
Yeah, I'm Michael Jordan.
All right. Well, hey, Joe, we want to thank so much for taking the time to talk with us. And again, everybody, remember, what's your website? JosephBedellBooks.com.
That's correct.
To find out more information, and you're on Facebook and everything else. So we want to thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, John.
And we will talk with you later.
Thank you very much.
All right.
And there we go, everybody. That's another interview we have, Joseph Bedell. Jeff was unavailable to that one because, I mean, he runs around Thriller Fest like a chicken with his head cut off. It was even good to even sit down for John and Joseph Fender that we're going to have up.
Well, I was moderating a panel at the time, and you couldn't wait for me.
I know. Well, that was the day, I remember that was the day of Pitch Fest, and that is a crazy freaking day when Pitch Fest goes on because not only are everybody running around like yourself, and then Shannon was running around, and you know she was having to do the practice thing. But all these authors that are pitching, it's like, I mean, this is it. I mean, it's like the finals of like Jeopardy or something. I don't know what it is, and they're all so anxious, and everybody's just so. It's a very stressful time.
It's true.
Okay, so good. Well, that's here we go. So now we're going to end the interviews with Joseph Fender. Again, you're going to hear some very exciting things in there, not only about his new book, The Fixer. Of course, Suspicion did not win the hardcover of the year, but he has been nominated three times. I think he's the only one to be nominated three times, so that's just great in itself.
Well, but he won once.
He did win once, yeah, nominated three times. He would have been the only two-time winner if he would have won. So,
CJ Lyons has won twice now.
She has in her category. I think, what was she, electronic? Was she electronic?
Yeah, she's ebook. She's won that twice.
Yeah. But you're going to hear what he did on the set of High Crimes. And then it was just a great interview with Joseph Fender. He's just a great guy. So
absolutely, yes.
You ready?
Let's do it.
All right, here we go.
So again, here we are at Thriller Fest. Jeff's here, and now we have the pleasure of speaking with mega author Joseph Fender, of course. And Joseph, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So Thriller Fest, this is the 10th anniversary of it, and we want to know, of course, now your book, Suspicion, is up for Best Hardcover nominee, which is a big thing, and like we were just talking off the air, you had won previous, so this would be your second win if you hit this one.
If I do it, yeah. You know? I think it's my third nomination.
Okay. So we'd like to know, you know, what does Thriller Fest mean to you, and someone who's coming maybe for the first time or was here, you know, what should they expect when they do come to this conference? Mm-hmm.
Thriller Fest is really kind of an amazing gathering of colleagues. It really is something which is really rare in the business. It's really rare among writers to actually find colleagues who want to support you, want to give you advice and help you out. Well, I'm helping out aspiring writers here. I'm being helped out by other writers. I get all kinds of advice from people here. It's a fantastic learning experience and a kind of a great supportive experience at the same time. Something like this did not exist when I was starting out writing. I mean, you know, I didn't know how to get an agent. I didn't know how to pitch a book. What do you do? How do you sell it? I had no idea. And I remember I went to the library and I was talking to the librarians there, and you know, nobody knew these things. These were like mysteries and secrets, right? So I had to sort of just guess and look through library books and write to agents who I had no idea if they'd be interested or not, right? So this is it's a whole different world now with Thriller Fest, where basically if you want to write a thriller, you come and you meet people who basically are number one bestsellers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
It's a life-changing experience for me, this conference. It really is. Okay, meet you, for example.
You too.
Talk about, I'm obviously a fan of your books. Each one of your novels is different, in a sense. Mm-hmm. And then they talk about a lot about branding, about how an author has to write the same thing but different.
Mm-hmm.
What is your brand?
I think my brand is the ordinary guy. Ordinary guy in an extraordinary world. Even in my Nick Heller thrillers, where I've got a serious character who is not an ordinary guy, but he's always working with helping out somebody who is. And so I sort of think of the ordinary guy in extraordinary circumstances as being the basic brand of what I do, whether I'm doing my serious novel or whether I'm doing my standalones. So you're right, they're different books. I don't like to repeat myself book after book, but branding is really about trust. And branding sort of means that a reader knows if he picks up the next Joe Fender book, he's going to like it, or she's going to like it. And that's sort of based on having a sense of what the world of the book is. And ideally, I believe they are similar book after book after book.
When you're sitting down and writing a new book, and of course your latest book out is called The Fixer, when you're sitting there and writing it, do you kind of, when you're plotting it and figuring out to writing it, do you say, you know what, I want to take a little risk in here and see if it works? Mm-hmm. And you kind of, you know, kind of maybe do it, and maybe it works, maybe it doesn't. But do you think about that in the process?
I do. I think about wanting to stretch my wings or my muscles or whatever you want to say. With each book, I want to do something a little bit different. In the case of The Fixer, I wanted to do something which was highly personal. I mean, it really is about the relationship between a father and a son. And in all my thrillers, I had never really delved very deeply into the kind of interpersonal connections in families. They were sort of more, you know, fast-paced, right, you know, action-adventure novels or novels of suspense. But I wanted to do something which was highly personal and felt very real to me as a writer, and therefore I hope to readers. So each book I do something different.
That's great. Mm-hmm. So I was talking to you the other day, and you did say that your next book is going to be another Heller, which I was actually pleased to hear about.
Right, yeah, right.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, I can.
I already asked. I know we don't know the title, and we can't say that part.
I'll say this. Yeah, I can't yet tell you the title. Soon, I'll be able to. Very soon.
Okay.
But
So it is the third in the Nick Heller series, and Nick Heller is what I call a private spy. He's not a private eye. He is someone who basically does the sort of work of an espionage officer, an espionage agent, in any world, whether it's in politics or whether it's in corporate or anything like that. So for me, I actually was away from Nick Heller for two books. I moved to a new publisher. They wanted me to do a couple of standalones. I did Suspicion and then The Fixer. So I was away from Nick Heller. And I had to reread one of my books to remind myself who Nick Heller is. It's like, oh, I was taking notes.
Yeah.
Like as if I were in college or something like that, taking notes.
A
like,
Nick Heller class.
Right. Oh, wait a second. Wait a minute. When was that again? Uh-huh. Right. He has a wound? Wait. Right. You know. So because I created Nick in a very full way in Vanished and Buried Secrets. And I had to remind myself who he was. But stepping back into the world of Nick Heller was actually really pleasurable. I mean, it's like, hey, I'm back with this old friend. I feel really comfortable here.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
And I have to admit, when I saw the title of The Fixer,
yeah,
I thought it was a Nick Heller book.
It sounds like a Nick Heller book.
Yeah, that's what I thought, too.
Right, exactly, because Nick Heller is in many ways a fixer behind the scenes.
Yes.
Right. But, well, I can't reuse the title.
No. So,
Bummer.
Fix it.
Right. Yeah.
But, you know, and just to go on that subject, but I'm going to take it into music, because that's a really funny thing that you had to go back and read, and Eddie Van Halen said the same thing when he was going on tour. He forgot how to play OU812 album, and he had to go back and listen to it and see, like, he said, I totally forgot how to play those songs.
It's funny.
And he had to go back and listen to them to figure it out.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things about being at Thriller Fest is I meet fans who have read my books going back for, you know.
And they probably know them all.
And they know way better than I do. It's like, remember in that book with Jason? It's like, who's Jason again?
Did I kill him? Or?
Right. Is he a hero or a villain? Remind me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, no, you just sort of, you write these things, you're completely immersed in them. You put them out, you have to move on to something else, and you forget the last book.
Well, and you're promoting the book you've already forgotten about, though.
Exactly. That is the difficult thing,
mm-hmm.
is that, you're right, here I am, I'm deeply immersed in the new Nick Heller, and I'm talking about The Fixer, and it's beginning to fade away.
The one thing that a lot of fans, and because two of your books have been made into major motion pictures,
right.
High Crimes and Paranoia.
Right.
And so fans kind of think, you know, that the author's involved 100%, and then that's why they get really upset. Like, well, how come the book, the movie wasn't as good as the book?
Right, why'd they change it?
Right, and why'd they do that thing? So, kind of say, what was your experience doing that? Because High Crimes was so fascinating.
He's got a cameo in there, too.
Yeah.
I'm in it.
And the ending of it was, and all of a sudden when you figure out, son of a bitch, it was him.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert,
you know,
come on.
Like, well, if they haven't read it by now, then, you know, screw them. But it's like, so how was kind of that process? Because, you know, we get to talk to very few authors that this has kind of happened to.
Yeah.
And so how was it for you?
Very different between the two movies, between High Crimes and Paranoia.
Is that because of the studios? Were they different studios?
I think, on the one hand, you know, High Crimes was a studio film. It was 20th Century Fox.
Yeah.
Paranoia was actually an independent film.
Oh.
It was not, you know.
With that cast? That's
really?
With Harrison Ford and Gary Oldman.
And Josh Hartnett was?
No, he wasn't.
Not Josh Hartnett.
Liam Hemsworth.
Liam, okay.
Yeah. So that was independent. And it felt like a very different experience. With High Crimes, they sent me the script. They wanted to know what I thought. They made some tweaks based on suggestions from me, right? With Paranoia, they sent me the script. I sent them around a 25-page letter with all kinds of notes about the script. I didn't even know if they got the email or not, you know? It was complete. They didn't want to hear from me.
Oh.
So, but the thing is, I don't want to make it sound as if I had any serious input on High Crimes, the movie. I really didn't. The writer in Hollywood, the writer is irrelevant, almost. It's funny but true. The writer of the book in cases like this. So I didn't have any kind of serious input, but I got to be in the movie.
That's great.
I sort of felt like I contributed, in a sense, to the project overall. Mm-hmm. I sort of was really in there for it. Paranoia, I was not invited to play a cameo appearance. Mm. I didn't feel like I had skin in the game. in the same way. As much as I wanted the movie to be really good, look, I was disappointed by Paranoia, the movie, to be honest. And I liked High Crimes a lot.
Yes, I thought it was great.
Yeah, that's a really good movie.
I'm a big Jim Caviezel fan, especially now Person of Interest.
Yes, Caviezel's great. Yeah, Person of Interest.
I can never pronounce his last name.
Yeah, no, it's all right. It's all right. You know who he is.
Yeah, he'll kill me if he ever stops.
Right. Anyway, yes. Yeah, exactly. So they were very different experiences in that sense. And Paranoia was... Look, a movie and a book are always going to be different. They have to be.
Right.
If you take a 400-page book and you boil it down to a script that's around 120 pages, double-spaced, with a lot of white space in it, you're cutting out a lot of characters and a lot of scenes. So, and I was okay with that. In fact, with High Crimes, I was actually really impressed with the way they combined two characters, the private eye at the beginning of the book and the lawyer, the Morgan Freeman character.
Okay.
Second, they actually made him into one role.
Yeah.
And I read that and the script, and I just thought, you know, I should have done that. That actually would have been great, you know? So I was impressed by that, by the compression that was involved with High Crimes. Paranoia, it wasn't a matter of compression, it was a matter of putting it in a completely different world. And I felt it sort of lost the essence of what Paranoia, the book, was about. But look, some people I know liked the movie a lot. They thought it was sort of a fun movie.
It was.
You know, and that's okay.
The people that I've heard who like the movie have not read the book, I've noticed.
Interesting. Yeah, if you read the book, you sort of get a little pissed off that they made these kind of changes.
Yes.
Right. But, you know, I cheered it on. I wanted Paranoia to be a big success. And it really was not. It was a flop.
Yeah.
And that was too bad. Because, you know, basically, my feeling is a movie is like this great, amazing billboard for the books. For me... A good movie, like in the case of High Crimes, brought in all kinds of fans to read my books. Say, I don't know, let's. There's a book here. All right, let's read that. And let's. I like this guy.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, I had many thousands of new fans.
Yeah. And so, where are you in the cameo? Because now I got to go back and watch the movie. I didn't even know where the cameo.
You shaved your head. I remember.
Exactly. Shaved my head. Yep. Wore my hair high and tight. I was in every courtroom scene.
Okay.
And there are five scenes, and I play an assistant JAG officer, prosecutor, really. So my job is to glare at Morgan Freeman. And I scowl. Basically, it's all I do in these scenes. I scowl at Morgan Freeman in his direction. There's actually a scene in the movie in which my character beats up Morgan Freeman. But it wasn't me.
The body double?
Yeah, exactly. They had someone else do it.
Oh, that is hilarious.
Yeah.
I love Morgan Freeman.
Yeah. Morgan Freeman was cool. And I have to say, I mean, I hung out with him on the set.
Yeah.
And we started singing songs to each other, you know. You'll never find as long as you live. That kind of stuff. You know, soul songs.
That's awesome.
It was great.
Is there any hope for future books being made into film or TV prospects? And my personal favorite of yours is still Zero Hour, and I keep hoping to see
that. Thank you. Zero Hour was sold to 20th Century Fox, in fact.
Okay.
But that was too long ago, and it went into turnaround, and it's unlikely, in my opinion, that's ever going to happen. That's the way Hollywood just sort of moves on.
Yeah.
They get all excited about something, it falls apart for one reason or another, and then they move on. The script for Zero Hour was really good. It's still a good story. I think it could work really well as a movie. There's no reason it can't.
Yeah.
So,
especially now.
Yeah, especially now. It's actually more timely.
Yeah,
so maybe if anyone's listening, any producer here is listening, right?
Well, hey, I'm in L.A., so, you know, I mean, that's the thing that always cracks me up is that Hollywood has so many built-in things right now that they can use, but what do? Another freaking Footloose movie or another one, and they just keep rehashing these things when they have all built-in, wonderful, great characters that they can rally around.
Yeah.
And like you said, maybe the writer drops out, and then the whole thing blows up, and it's like, okay, we're done.
We're done, right. Fell apart.
Really? That's all it took?
Yeah, millions of dollars are spent developing movies that then just fall apart.
Yeah.
It's sort of a waste of so much money and time and energy and effort, human, effort, which is why I'm glad that I actually am in a different business entirely. I mean, I write books, when I invest time in something, you actually see it in the page.
Yeah.
Could you talk a bit about being the difference between being solitary, sitting on your computer at home, typing away, and then coming to an event like this?
Yeah, it's an interesting question because, first of all, I am not an introvert. I am generally an extroverted person. And, you know, in college and in my life, I'm generally extroverted. But I spend hours a day by myself staring at a computer. And you become unused to that kind of interaction with people. So that I come to Thriller Fest, and all of a sudden it's like, wow! There's all these people, and they're shouting at you. Hey, Joe!
I know.
We met in Colorado! You know, and it's kind of disorienting.
Yeah.
I mean, I find this, I've talked to a number of thriller writers here who have the same experience. We sit there by ourselves, and all of a sudden, you're in this insane crowd of people. It's like this amazing cocktail party with all these people who want to meet you,
mm-hmm.
which is completely flattering. But it's hard to get used to. So then I sort of, what I do is I find myself going up to the room and I sort of sit there and I meditate for a few minutes just to sort of, you know, regain some composure.
Well, you know, we want to thank you so much for taking the time out to speak with us, and we know that, you know, your time is very short. So why don't you just, you know, let everybody know kind of the best place for them to find out everything that they want to know about Joseph Fender.
Everything about Joseph Fender is on my website, josephfender.com. Also, I'm on Facebook, mm-hmm. Facebook.com/Joseph Fender. And I'm on Twitter. I am everywhere. So
you're everywhere.
You can't escape.
You can't escape. But we want to thank you so much for doing this, Joe. It's been such
here.
A pleasure.
Thank
again,
you so
thanks
we
so much.
We can say a highlight of Thriller Fest is we were yelled at by Joseph Fender.
We were. I was literally like, oh my God, I'm awake now.
Sorry about
all
that.
Right.
Oh, that's awesome.
Now you know what it feels like.
I know. You know, I don't know if I want to reach that level now. All right. Thanks again, Joe.
Thanks a lot.
Appreciate it.
Great.
Yes, everybody. I forgot all about that, Jeff, that we were scared to death by Joseph Fender, because that came out of nowhere when he just yelled.
I thought I was going to lose my, well, anyway.
Yeah,
it was
because if people don't know Joseph, I mean, of course you know his books, but if you don't really know, I mean, he's kind of a quiet guy. I mean, he's always around Thriller Fest. I mean, I see him probably just as much as I see, like, David Morrell and John Land I see a lot. You know, there's a lot of authors that you just don't see a lot of. I mean, quite frankly, maybe on their panels. But Joseph, you just always see around. He's just this quiet kind of guy. You walk up and you're like, hey, Joseph, you know, I love your books. He's like, oh, thank you very much. And then when he yells at you, you're just like, whoa, shit, dude. Sorry. Yeah.
Yes.
It would be even more scary if he had like a Russian accent, because I've always said that if you get yelled at in Russian, German, or Arabic, shit is getting blown up, like, right in front of you if you hear that language. You can't get yelled at in French and be scared. I'm sorry. That's why Napoleon just was not, he wasn't scared. I mean, he's a little 5'4" guy, and he's yelling at you, oui, oui, you go that way. And it's like, you're not scary, dude. Not at, like, at all. But,
well, that's why he carried a gun. But, yes.
Well, yeah, he had to. Yeah, he had to carry the gun because the other thing wasn't big. Anyway, we won't even go into his other gun. So, but that was great. And we got some left, and we'll let everybody know that who we have coming up is still left is we have Hank Philip P. Ryan, we have Jamie Fravoletti, we have Robert Wilson, we have Peter James, and we have Scott Turow. So we have five left. On our next show with Kevin O'Brien, we are going to play, I think, who did we say? We're going to play Scott Turow's interview next
yes.
week on the back half of Kevin O'Brien's interview. And then we'll do another show probably with Robert, Jamie, and Hank. And then we'll have Peter James on the back half of the show on August 24th. And that'll be our Thriller Fest interviews. And that's it. It's all done.
That's kind of sad because it was so much fun doing all those. And, yeah, anyway.
It is. But we're only halfway through. So that's a good thing. We've only done six. We got five left, so we're only halfway through. So if you look at it as like sex, halfway through sex is still really good time. So we're still okay. So we're still on par to really have a good climax. And with that, that's how we'll end the show.
I have no response to that.
Yeah. You just never know what's coming out of my mouth. That's what
TMI, my friend, TMI.
That's all right. Hey, you know, you've been married a long time. I've been married a long time. We've had a lot of sex with our partners, so why not just tell everybody? You know, there's no mystery in that. The suspense part is, when are we going to have it again? Because that's the suspense part. I'll tell you.
Good night, kids.
All right, everybody. Samantha, you make sure that you tune out right on about the 45 mark. So you have to make sure you tell it. Okay, right after the Joseph Fender interview, you have to turn it off the radio. All right. I tell you.
Yes.
All right. All right, everybody. We will see you all next week again, 7:30, same time Pacific, with Kevin O'Brien and Scott Turow interview from Thriller Fest. So, Jeff, it's always a pleasure, man. We'll see you in a week.
Sounds great. Thanks again.
All right. And let's leave them all with this one.